Neither procedure would be required if our eye movements were apprehended immediately, by pure muscular feeling or innervation, for example, as distinct lengths and directions in space. To compare retinal tracts, it would then suffice simply to notice how it feels to move any image over them. And two objective lines could be compared as well by moving different retinal tracts along them as by laying them along the same. It would be as easy to compare non-parallel figures as it now is to judge of those which are parallel. Those which it took the same amount of movement to traverse would be equal, in whatever direction the movement occurred. General summary. With this we may end our long and, I fear to many readers, tediously minute survey. The facts of vision form a jungle of intricacy, and those who penetrate deeply into physiological optics will be more struck by our omissions than by our abundance of detail. But for students who may have lost sight of the forest for the trees, I will recapitulate briefly the points of our whole argument from the beginning, and then proceed to a short historical survey, which will set them in relief. All our sensations are positively and inexplicably extensive wholes. The sensations contributing to space, perception seem exclusively to be the surface of skin, retina, and joints. Muscular feelings play no appreciable part in the generation of our feelings of form, direction, etc. The total bigness of a cutaneous or retinal feeling soon becomes subdivided by discriminative attention. Movements assist this discrimination by reason of the peculiarly exciting quality of the sensations which stimuli moving over surfaces arouse. Subdivisions, once discriminated, acquire definite relations of position towards each other within the total space. These relations are themselves feelings of the subdivisions that intervene. When these subdivisions are not the seat of stimuli, the relations are only reproduced in imaginary form. The various sense spaces are, in the first instance, incoherent with each other, and primitively both they and their subdivisions are but vaguely comparable in point of bulk and form. The education of our space perception consists largely of two processes: reducing the various sense feelings to a common measure, and adding them together into the single all-including space of the real world. Both the measuring and the adding are performed by the aid of things. The imagined aggregate of positions occupied by all the actual or possible, moving or stationary, things which we know, is our notion of real space, a very incomplete and vague conception in all minds. The measuring of our space feelings against each other mainly comes about through the successive arousal of different ones by the same thing, by our selection of certain ones as feelings of its real size and shape, and by the degradation of others to the status of being merely signs of these. For the successive application of the same thing to different space-giving surfaces, motion is indispensable, and hence plays a great part in our space education, especially in that of the eye. Abstractly considered, the motion of the object over the sensitive surface would educate us quite as well as that of the surface over the object. But the self-mobility of the organ carrying the surface accelerates immensely the result. In completely educated space perception, the present sensation is usually just what Helmholtz, Physio-Optik, page 797, calls it a sign, the interpretation of whose meaning is left to the understanding. But the understanding is exclusively reproductive and never productive in the process, and its function is limited to the recall of previous space sensations with which the present one has been associated and which may be judged more real than it. Finally, this reproduction may, in the case of certain visual forms, be as vivid, or almost so, as actual sensation is. The third dimension forms an original element of all our space sensations. In the eye, it is subdivided by various discriminations. The more distant subdivisions are often shut out altogether, and, in being suppressed, have the effect of diminishing the absolute space value of the total field of view. Historical. Let us now close with a brief historical survey. The first achievement of note in the study of space perception was Berkeley's theory of vision. This undertook to establish two points: first, that distance was not a visual but a tactile form of consciousness, suggested by visual signs; secondly, that there is no one quality or idea common to the sensations of touch and sight, such that prior to experience one might possibly anticipate from the look of an object anything about its felt size, shape, or position, or from the touch of it anything about its look. In other words, that primitively chaotic or semi-chaotic condition of our various sense spaces which we have demonstrated, was established for good by Berkeley, and he bequeathed to psychology the problem of describing the manner in which the deliverances are harmonized so as all to refer to one and the same extended world. His disciples in Great Britain have solved this problem after Berkeley's own fashion, and to a great extent as we have done ourselves, by the ideas of the various senses suggesting each other in consequence of association. But, either because they were intoxicated with the principle of association, or because in the number of details they lost their general bearings, they have forgotten, as a rule, to state under what sensible form the primitive spatial experiences are found which later became associated with so many other sensible signs. Heedless of their master Locke's precept, that the mind can frame unto itself no one new simple idea, they seem for the most part to be trying to explain the extensive quality itself, account for it, and evolve it, by the mere association together of feelings which originally possessed it not. They first evaporate the nature of extension by making it tantamount to mere coexistence, and then they explain coexistence as being the same thing as succession, provided it be an extremely rapid or a reversible succession. Space perception thus emerges without being anywhere postulated. The only things postulated are unextended feelings and time. Says Thomas Brown, Lecture 23, I am inclined to reverse exactly the process commonly supposed, and instead of deriving the measure of time from extension, to derive the knowledge and original measure of extension from time. Brown and both the Mills think that retinal sensations, colors, in their primitive condition, are felt with no extension and that the latter merely becomes inseparably associated with them. John Mill says, whatever may be the retinal impression conveyed by a line which bounds two colors, I see no ground for thinking that by the eye alone we could acquire the conception of what we now mean when we say that one of the colors is outside the other. Whence does the extension come which gets so inseparably associated with these non-extended colored sensations? From the sweep and movements of the eye, from muscular feelings. But, as Professor Bain says, if movement feelings give us any property of things, it would seem to be not space, but time. And John Mill says that, the idea of space is, at bottom, one of time. Space, then, is not to be found in any elementary sensation, but, in Bain's words, as a quality, it has no other origin and no other meaning than the association of these different motor and sensitive effects. This phrase is mystical sounding enough to one who understands association as producing nothing, but only as knitting together things already produced in separate ways. The truth is that the English associationist school, in trying to show how much their principle can accomplish, have altogether overshot the mark and espoused a kind of theory in respect to space perception which the general tenor of their philosophy should lead them to abhor. Really, there are but three possible kinds of theory concerning space. Either, 1, there is no spatial quality of sensation at all, and space is a mere symbol of succession, or, 2, there is an extensive quality given immediately in certain particular sensations, or, finally, 3, there is a quality produced out of the inward resources of the mind, to envelop sensations which, as given originally, are not spatial, but which, on being cast into the spatial form, become united and orderly. This last is the Kantian view. Stumpf admirably designates it as the psychic stimulus theory, the crude sensations being considered as goads to the mind to put forth its slumbering power. Brown, the Mills, and Bain, amid these possibilities, seem to have gone astray like lost sheep. With the mental chemistry, of which the Mills speak precisely the same thing as the psychical synthesis of Wundt, which, as we shall soon see, is a principle expressly intended to do what association can never perform, they hold the third view, but again in other places imply the first. And, between the impossibility of getting from mere association anything not contained in the sensations associated and the dislike to allow spontaneous mental productivity, they flounder in a dismal dilemma. Mr. Sully joins them there in what I must call a vague and vacillating way. Mr. Spencer, of course, is bound to pretend to evolve all mental qualities out of antecedents different from themselves, so that we need perhaps not wonder at his refusal to accord the spatial quality to any of the several elementary sensations out of which our space perception grows. That a sensation be discriminated as apart from out of a larger enveloping space is then the conditio sine qua non of its being apprehended in a definite spatial order. The problem of ordering our feelings in space is then, in the first instance, a problem of discrimination, but not of discrimination pure and simple, for then not only coexistent sights but coexistent sounds would necessarily assume such order, which they notoriously do not. Whatever is discriminated will appear as a small space within a larger space, it is true, but this is but the very rudiment of order. For the location of it within that space to become precise, other conditions still must supervene, and the best way to study what they are will be to pause for a little and analyze what the expression, spatial order, means. Spatial order is an abstract term. The concrete perceptions which it covers are figures, directions, positions, magnitudes, and distances. To single out any one of these things from a total vastness is partially to introduce order into the vastness. To subdivide the vastness into a multitude of these things is to apprehend it in a completely orderly way. Now, what are these things severally? To begin with, no one can for an instant hesitate to say that some of them are qualities of sensation, just as the total vastness is in which they lie. Take figure, a square, a circle, and a triangle appear in the first instance to the eye simply as three different kinds of impressions, each so peculiar that we should recognize it if it were to return. When Nunnally's patient had his cataracts removed, and a cube and a sphere were presented to his notice, he could at once perceive a difference in their shapes, and though he could not say which was the cube and which the sphere, he saw they were not of the same figure. So of lines, if we can notice lines at all in our field of vision, it is inconceivable that a vertical one should not affect us differently from an horizontal one, and should not be recognized as affecting us similarly when presented again, although we might not yet know the name vertical, or any of its connotations, beyond this peculiar affection of our sensibility. So of angles, an obtuse one affects our feeling immediately in a different way from an acute one. Distance apart, too, is a simple sensation. The sensation of a line joining the two distant points, lengthen the line, you alter the feeling and with it the distance felt. Space relations. But with distance and direction we pass to the category of space relations, and are immediately confronted by an opinion which makes of all relations something totosilla different from all facts of feeling or imagination whatsoever. A relation, for the Platonizing school in psychology, is an energy of pure thought, and, as such, is quite incommensurable with the data of sensibility between which it may be perceived to obtain. We may consequently imagine a disciple of this school to say to us at this point, suppose you have made a separate specific sensation of each line and each angle, what boots it? You have still the order of directions and of distances to account for, you have still the relative magnitudes of all these felt figures to state, you have their respective positions to define before you can be said to have brought order into your space. And not one of these determinations can be effected except through an act of relating thought, so that your attempt to give an account of space in terms of pure sensibility breaks down almost at the very outset. Position, for example, can never be a sensation, for it has nothing intrinsic about it, it can only obtain between a spot, line, or other figure and extraneous coordinates, and can never be an element of the sensible datum, the line, or the spot, in itself. Let us then confess that thought alone can unlock the riddle of space, and that thought is an adorable but unfathomable mystery. Such a method of dealing with the problem has the merit of shortness. Let us, however, be in no such hurry, but see whether we cannot get a little deeper by patiently considering what these space relations are. Relation is a very slippery word. It has so many different concrete meanings that the use of it as an abstract universal may easily introduce bewilderment into our thought. We must therefore be careful to avoid ambiguity by making sure, wherever we have to employ it, what its precise meaning is in that particular sphere of application. At present we have to do with space relations, and no others. Most relations are feelings of an entirely different order from the terms they relate. The relation of similarity, example, may equally obtain between jasmine and tuberose, or between Mr. Browning's verses and Mr. Story's, it is itself neither odorous nor poetical, and those may well be pardoned who have denied to it all sensational content whatever. But just as, in the field of quantity, the relation between two numbers is another number, so in the field of space the relations are facts of the same order with the facts they relate. If these latter be patches in the circle of vision, the former are certain other patches between them. When we speak of the relation of direction of two points toward each other, we mean simply the sensation of the line that joins the two points together. The line is the relation, feel it and you feel the relation, see it and you see the relation, nor can you in any conceivable way think the latter except by imagining the former, however vaguely, or describe or indicate the one except by pointing to the other. And the moment you have imagined the line, the relation stands before you in all its completeness, with nothing further to be done. Just so the relation of direction between two lines is identical with the peculiar sensation of shape of the space enclosed between them. This is commonly called an angular relation. If these relations are sensations, no less so are the relations of position. The relation of position between the top and bottom points of a vertical line is that line, and nothing else. The relations of position between a point and a horizontal line below it are potentially numerous. There is one more important than the rest, called its distance. This is the sensation, ideal or actual, of a perpendicular drawn from the point to the line. Two lines, one from each extremity of the horizontal to the point, give us a peculiar sensation of triangularity. This feeling may be said to constitute the locus of all the relations of position of the elements in question. Rightness and leftness, upness and downness, are again pure sensations differing specifically from each other, and generically from everything else. Like all sensations, they can only be indicated, not described. If we take a cube and label one side top, another bottom, a third front, and a fourth back, there remains no form of words by which we can describe to another person which of the remaining sides is right and which left. We can only point and say here is right and there is left, just as we should say this is red and that blue. Of two points seen beside each other at all, one is always affected by one of these feelings, and the other by the opposite. The same is true of the extremities of any line. Thus it appears indubitable that all space relations except those of magnitude are nothing more or less than pure sensational objects. But magnitude appears to outstep this narrow sphere. We have relations of muchness and littleness between times, numbers, intensities, and qualities, as well as spaces. It is impossible, then, that such relations should form a particular kind of simply spatial feeling. This we must admit, the relation of quantity is generic and occurs in many categories of consciousness, whilst the other relations we have considered are specific and occur in space alone. When our attention passes from a shorter line to a longer, from a smaller spot to a larger, from a feebler light to a stronger, from a paler blue to a richer, from a march tune to a gallop, the transition is accompanied in the synthetic field of consciousness by a peculiar feeling of difference which is what we call the sensation of more length, more expanse, more light, more blue, more motion. Thus, Psychology, 2. 168, 172, 218. No idea of extension can arise from a simultaneous excitation of a multitude of nerve terminations like those of the skin or the retina, since this would imply a knowledge of their relative positions, that is, a pre-existent idea of a special extension, which is absurd. No relation between successive states of consciousness gives in itself any idea of extension. The muscular sensations accompanying motion are quite distinct from the notions of space and time associated with them. Mr. Spencer nonetheless inveighs vociferously against the Kantian position that space is produced by the mind's own resources. And yet he nowhere denies space to be a specific affection of consciousness different from time. Such incoherency is pitiful. The fact is that, at bottom, all these authors are really psychical stimulists or Kantists. The space they speak of is a supersensational mental product. This position appears to me thoroughly mythological. But let us see how it is held by those who know more definitely what they mean. Schopenhauer expresses the Kantian view with more vigor and clearness than anyone else. He says, "A man must be forsaken by all the gods to dream that the world we see outside of us, filling space in its three dimensions, moving down the inexorable stream of time, governed at each step by causality's invariable law, but in all this only following rules which we may prescribe for it in advance of all experience, to dream, I say, that such a world should stand there outside of us, quite objectively real with no complicity of ours. And thereupon by a subsequent act, through the instrumentality of mere sensation, that it should enter our head and reconstruct a duplicate of itself as it was outside. For what a poverty-stricken thing is this mere sensation. Even in the noblest organs of sense it is nothing more than a local and specific feeling, susceptible within its kind of a few variations, but always strictly subjective and containing in itself nothing objective, nothing resembling a perception. For sensation of every sort is and remains a process in the organism itself. As such, it is limited to the territory inside the skin and can never, accordingly, per se contain anything that lies outside the skin or outside ourselves. Only when the understanding is roused to activity and brings its sole and only form, the law of causality, into play, only then does the mighty transformation take place which makes out of subjective sensation objective intuition. The understanding, namely, grasps by means of its innate, a priori, anti-experiential form, the given sensation of the body as an effect which as such must necessarily have a cause. At the same time, the understanding summons to its aid the form of the outer sense which similarly lies already preformed in the intellect, or brain, and which is space, in order to locate that cause outside of the organism. In this process the understanding, as I shall soon show, takes note of the most minute peculiarities of the given sensation in order to construct in the outer space a cause which shall completely account for them. This operation of the understanding is, however, not one that takes place discursively, reflectively, in abstracto, by means of words and concepts, but is intuitive and immediate. Thus the understanding must first create the objective world. Never can the latter, already complete in SE, simply promenade into our heads through the senses and organic apertures. For the senses yield us nothing further than the raw material which must be first elaborated into the objective conception of an orderly physical world system by means of the aforesaid simple forms of space, time, and causality. Let me show the great chasm between sensation and perception by showing how raw the material is out of which the fair structure is upreared. Only two senses serve objective perception, touch and sight. They alone furnish the data on the basis whereof the understanding, by the process indicated, erects the objective world. These data in themselves are still no perception, that is the understanding's work. If I press with my hand against the table, the sensation I receive has no analogy with the idea of the firm cohesion of the parts of this mass. Only when my understanding passes from the sensation to its cause does it create for itself a body with the properties of solidity, impenetrability, and hardness. When in the dark I lay my hand on a surface, or grasp a ball of 3 inches diameter, in either case the same parts of the hand receive the impression, but out of the different contraction of the hand in the two cases my understanding constructs the form of the body whose contact caused the feeling, and confirms its construction by leading me to move my hand over the body. If one born blind handles a cubical body, the sensations of his hand are quite uniform on all sides and in all directions, only the corners press upon a smaller part of his skin. In these sensations, as such, there is nothing whatever analogous to a cube. But from the felt resistance his understanding infers immediately and intuitively a cause thereof, which now presents itself as a solid body, and from the movements of exploration which the arms made whilst the feelings of the hands remained constant he constructs, in the space known to him a priori, the body's cubical shape. Did he not bring with him ready-made the idea of a cause and of a space, with the laws thereof, there never could arise, out of those successive feelings in his hand, the image of a cube. If we let a string run through our closed hand, we immediately construct as the cause of the friction and its duration in such an attitude of the hand, a long cylindrical body moving uniform in one direction. But never out of the pure sensation in the hand could the idea of movement, that is, of change of position in space by means of time, arise. Such a content can never lie in sensation, nor come out of it. Our intellect, antecedently to all experience, must bear in itself the intuitions of space and time, and therewithal of the possibility of motion, and no less the idea of causality, to pass from the empirically given feeling to its cause, and to construct the latter as a so-moving body of the designated shape. For how great is the abyss between the mere sensation in the hand and the ideas of causality, materiality, and movement through space, occurring in time. The feeling in the hand, even with different contacts and positions, is something far too uniform and poor in content for it to be possible to construct out of it the idea of space with its three dimensions, of the action of bodies on each other, with the properties of extension, impenetrability, cohesion, shape, hardness, softness, rest, and motion, in short, the foundations of the objective world. This is only possible through space, time, and causality, being preformed in the intellect itself, from whence it again follows that the perception of the external world is essentially an intellectual process, a work of the understanding, to which sensation furnishes merely the occasion, and the data to be interpreted in each particular case. I call this view mythological, because I am conscious of no such Kantian machine shop in my mind, and feel no call to disparage the powers of poor sensation in this merciless way. I have no introspective experience of mentally producing or creating space. My space intuitions occur not in two times but in one. There is not one moment of passive inextensive sensation, succeeded by another of active extensive perception, but the form I see is as immediately felt as the color which fills it out. That the higher parts of the mind come in, who can deny? They add and subtract, they compare and measure, they reproduce and abstract. They inweave the space sensations with intellectual relations, but these relations are the same when they obtain between the elements of the space system as when they obtain between any of the other elements of which the world is made. The essence of the Kantian contention is that there are not spaces, but space, one infinite continuous unit, and that our knowledge of this cannot be a piecemeal sensational affair, produced by summation and abstraction. To which the obvious reply is that, if any known thing bears on its front the appearance of piecemeal construction and abstraction, it is this very notion of the infinite unitary space of the world. It is a notion, if ever there was one, and no intuition. Most of us apprehend it in the barest symbolic abridgment, and if perchance we ever do try to make it more adequate, we just add one image of sensible extension to another until we are tired. Most of us are obliged to turn round and drop the thought of the space in front of us when we think of that behind. And the space represented as near to us seems more minutely subdivisible than that we think of as lying far away. Asterisk, 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 asterisk. The other prominent German writers on space are also psychical stimulists. Herbart, whose influence has been widest, says, "The resting eye sees no space," and ascribes visual extension to the influence of movements combining with the non-spatial retinal feeling so as to form gradated series of the latter. A given sensation of such a series reproduces the idea of its associates in regular order, and its idea is similarly reproduced by any one of them with the order reversed. Out of the fusion of these two contrasted reproductions comes the form of space, heaven knows how. The obvious objection is that mere serial order is a genus, and space order a very peculiar species of that genus, and that, if the terms of reversible series became by that fact coexistent terms in space, the musical scale, the degrees of warmth and cold, and all other ideally graded series ought to appear to us in the shape of extended corporeal aggregates, which they notoriously do not, though we may of course symbolize their order by a spatial scheme. W. Volkmann von Volkmer, the Herbartian, takes the bull here by the horns, and says the musical scale is spatially extended, though he admits that its space does not belong to the real world. I am unacquainted with any other Herbartian so bold. Asterisk, 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 asterisk. To Lotze we owe the much-used term, local sign. He insisted that space could not emigrate directly into the mind from without, but must be reconstructed by the soul, and he seemed to think that the first reconstructions of it by the soul must be supersensational. But why sensations themselves might not be the soul's original spatial reconstructive acts Lotze fails to explain. Wundt has all his life devoted himself to the elaboration of a space theory, of which the neatest and most final expression is to be found in his Logik, 2. 457-60, he says. In the eye, space perception has certain constant peculiarities which prove that no single optical sensation by itself possesses the extensive form, but that everywhere in our perception of space heterogeneous feelings combine. If we simply suppose that luminous sensations per se feel extensive, our supposition is shattered by that influence of movement in vision which is so clearly to be traced in many normal errors in the measurement of the field of view. If we assume, on the other hand, that the movements and their feelings are alone possessed of the extensive quality, we make an unjustified hypothesis, for the phenomena compel us, it is true, to accord an influence to movement, but give us no right to call the retinal sensations indifferent, for there are no visual ideas without retinal sensations. If then we wish rigorously to express the given facts, we can ascribe a spatial constitution only to combinations of retinal sensations with those of movement. Thus Wundt, dividing theories into nativistic and genetic, calls his own a genetic theory. To distinguish it from other theories of the same class, He names it a theory of complex local signs. It supposes two systems of local signs, whose relations, taking the eye as an example, we may think as the measuring of the manifold local sign system of the retina by the simple local sign system of the movements. In its psychological nature, this is a process of associative synthesis. It consists in the fusion of both groups of sensations into a product, whose elementary components are no longer separable from each other in idea. In melting wholly away into the product which they create, they become consciously undistinguishable, and the mind apprehends only their resultant, the intuition of space. Thus there obtains a certain analogy between this psychic synthesis and the chemical synthesis which out of simple bodies generates a compound that appears to our immediate perception as a homogeneous whole with new properties. Now let no modest reader think that if this sounds obscure to him it is because he does not know the full context, and that if a wise professor like Wundt can talk so fluently and plausibly about combination and psychic synthesis, it must surely be because those words convey a so much greater fullness of positive meaning to the scholarly than to the unlearned mind. Really, it is quite the reverse. All the virtue of the phrase lies in its mere sound and skin. Learning does but make one the more sensible of its inward unintelligibility. Wundt's theory is the flimsiest thing in the world. It starts by an untrue assumption, and then corrects it by an unmeaning phrase. Retinal sensations are spatial, and were they not, no amount of synthesis with equally spaceless motor sensations could intelligibly make them so. Wundt's theory is, in short, but an avowal of impotence, and an appeal to the inscrutable powers of the soul. It confesses that we cannot analyze the constitution or give the genesis of the spatial quality in consciousness. But at the same time it says the antecedents thereof are psychical and not cerebral facts. In calling the quality in question a sensational quality, our own account equally disclaimed ability to analyze it, but said its antecedents were cerebral, not psychical. In other words, that it was a first psychical thing. This is merely a question of probable fact, which the reader may decide. And now what shall be said of Helmholtz? Can I find fault with a book which, on the whole, I imagine to be one of the four or five greatest monuments of human genius in the scientific line? If truth impels, I must fain try, and take the risks. It seems to me that Helmholtz's genius moves most securely when it keeps close to particular facts. At any rate, it shows least strong in purely speculative passages, which in the optics, in spite of many beauties, seem to me fundamentally vacillating and obscure. The empiristic view which Helmholtz defends is that the space determinations we perceive are in every case products of a process of unconscious inference. The inference is similar to one from induction or analogy. We always see that form before us which habitually would have caused the sensation we now have. But the latter sensation can never be intrinsically spatial, or its intrinsic space determinations would never be overcome as they are so often by the illusory space determinations it so often suggests. Since the illusory determination can be traced to a suggestion of experience, the real one must also be such a suggestion, so that all space intuitions are due solely to experience. The only psychic activity required for this is the association of ideas. But how, it may be asked, can association produce a space quality not in the things associated? How can we by induction or analogy infer what we do not already generically know? Can suggestions of experience reproduce elements which no particular experience originally contained? This is the point by which Helmholtz's empiristic theory, as a theory, must be judged. No theory is worthy of the name which leaves such a point obscure. Well, Helmholtz does so leave it. At one time he seems to fall back on inscrutable powers of the soul, and to range himself with the psychical stimulists. He speaks of Kant as having made the essential step in the matter in distinguishing the content of experience from that form space, course which is given it by the peculiar faculties of the mind. But elsewhere, again, speaking of sensationalistic theories which would connect spatially determinate feelings directly with certain neural events, he says it is better to assume only such simple psychic activities as we know to exist, and gives the association of ideas as an instance of what he means. Later, he reinforces this remark by confessing that he does not see how any neural process can give rise without antecedent experience to a ready-made, furtive, perception of space. And, finally, in a single momentous sentence, he speaks of sensations of touch as if they might be the original material of our space percepts, which thus, from the optical point of view, may be assumed as given. Of course the eye man has a right to fall back on the skin man for help at a pinch. But doesn't this mean that he is a mere eye man and not a complete psychologist? In other words, Helmholtz's optics and the empiristic theory therein professed must not be understood as attempts at answering the general question of how space consciousness enters the mind. They simply deny that it enters with the first optical sensations. Our own account has affirmed stoutly that it enters then, but no more than Helmholtz have we pretended to show why. Who calls a thing a first sensation admits he has no theory of its production. Helmholtz, though all the while without an articulate theory, makes the world think he has one. He beautifully traces the immense part which reproductive processes play in our vision of space, and never except in that one pitiful little sentence about touch does he tell us just what it is they reproduce. He limits himself to denying that they reproduce originals of a visual sort. And so difficult is the subject, and so magically do catchwords work on the popular scientist ear, that most likely, had he written physiological instead of nativistic, and spiritualistic instead of empiristic, which synonyms Herring suggests, numbers of his present empirical evolutionary followers would fail to find in his teaching anything worthy of praise. But since he wrote otherwise, they hurrah for him as a sort of second Locke, dealing another death blow at the old bugaboo of innate ideas. His nativistic adversary Herring, they probably imagine, heaven save the mark, to be a scholastic in modern disguise. After Wundt and Helmholtz, the most important anti-sensationalist space philosopher in Germany is Professor Lips, whose deduction of space from an order of non-spatial differences, continuous yet separate, is a wonderful piece of subtlety and logic. And yet he has to confess that continuous differences form in the first instance only a logical series, which need not appear spatial, and that wherever it does so appear, this must be accounted a fact, due merely to the nature of the soul. Lips, and almost all the anti-sensationalist theorists except Helmholtz, seem guilty of that confusion which Mr. Shadworth Hodgson has done so much to clear away, viz., the confounding the analysis of an idea with the means of its production. Lips, for example, finds that every space we think of can be broken up into positions, and concludes that in some undefined way the several positions must have pre-existed in thought before the aggregate space could have appeared to perception. Similarly, Mr. Spencer, defining extension as an aggregate of relations of coexistent position, says, every cognition of magnitude is a cognition of relations of position, and no idea of extension can arise from the simultaneous excitation of many nerves unless there is a knowledge of their relative positions. Just so Professor Bain insists that the very meaning of space is scope for movement, and that therefore distance and magnitude can be no original attributes of the eye's sensibility. Similarly, because movement is analyzable into positions occupied at successive moments by the mover, philosophers, e.g. Schopenhauer, as quoted above, have repeatedly denied the possibility of its being an immediate sensation. We have, however, seen that it is the most immediate of all our space sensations. Because it can only occur in a definite direction, the impossibility of perceiving it without perceiving its direction has been decreed, a decree which the simplest experiment overthrows. It is a case of what I have called the psychologist's fallacy. Mere acquaintance with space is treated as tantamount to every sort of knowledge about it, the conditions of the latter are demanded of the former state of mind, and all sorts of mythological processes are brought in to help. As well might one say that because the world consists of all its parts, therefore we can only apprehend it at all by having unconsciously summed these up in our head. It is the old idea of our actual knowledge being drawn out from a pre-existent potentiality, an idea which, whatever worth it may metaphysically possess, does no good in psychology. My own sensationalistic account has derived most aid and comfort from the writings of Herring, A. W. Volkmann, Stumpf, Luconti, and Schaun. All these authors allow ample scope to that experience which Berkeley's genius saw to be a present factor in all our visual acts. But they give experience some grist to grind, which the soi distant empiristic school forgets to do. Stumpf seems to me the most philosophical and profound of all these writers, and I owe him much. I should doubtless have owed almost as much to Mr. James Ward, had his article on psychology in the Encyclopaedia Britannica appeared before my own thoughts were written down. The literature of the question is in all languages very voluminous. I content myself with referring to the bibliography in Helmholtz's and Aubert's works on physiological optics for the visual part of the subject, and with naming in a note the ablest works in the English tongue which have treated of the subject in a general way. To clear up our thoughts about this latter mystery, let us take the case of an actual line of light, none of whose parts is ideal. The feeling of the line is produced, as we know, when a multitude of retinal points are excited together, each of which when excited separately would give rise to one of the feelings called local signs. Each of these signs is the feeling of a small space. From their simultaneous arousal we might well suppose a feeling of larger space to result. But why is it necessary that in this larger spaciousness the sign A should appear always at one end of the line, Z at the other, and M in the middle? For though the line be a unitary streak of light, its several constituent points can nevertheless break out from it, and become alive, each for itself, under the selective eye of attention. The uncritical reader, giving his first careless glance at the subject, will say that there is no mystery in this, and that, of course, local signs must appear alongside of each other, each in its own place, there is no other way possible. But the more philosophic student, whose business it is to discover difficulties quite as much as to get rid of them, will reflect that it is conceivable that the partial factors might fuse into a larger space, and yet not each be located within it any more than a voice is located in a chorus. He will wonder how, after combining into the line, the points can become severally alive again, the separate puffs of a siren no longer strike the ear after they have fused into a certain pitch of sound. He will recall the fact that when, after looking at things with one eye closed, we double, by opening the other eye, the number of retinal points affected, the new retinal sensations do not as a rule appear alongside of the old ones and additional to them, but merely make the old ones seem larger and nearer. Why should the affection of new points on the same retina have so different a result? In fact, he will see no sort of logical connection between 1. The original separate local signs, 2. The line as a unit, 3. The line with the points discriminated in it, and 4. The various nerve processes which subserve all these different things. He will suspect our local sign of being a very slippery and ambiguous sort of creature. Positionless at first, it no sooner appears in the midst of a gang of companions than it is found maintaining the strictest position of its own, and assigning place to each of its associates. How is this possible? Must we accept what we rejected a while ago as absurd, and admit the points each to have position in SE? Or must we suspect that our whole construction has been fallacious, and that we have tried to conjure up, out of association, qualities which the associates never contained? There is no doubt a real difficulty here, and the shortest way of dealing with it would be to confess it insoluble and ultimate. Even if position be not an intrinsic character of any one of those sensations we have called local signs, we must still admit that there is something about every one of them that stands for the potentiality of position, and is the ground why the local sign, when it gets placed at all, gets placed here rather than there. If this something be interpreted as a physiological something, as a mere nerve process, it is easy to say in a blank way that when it is excited alone, it is an ultimate fact, one, that a positionless spot will appear. That when it is excited together with other similar processes, but without the process of discriminative attention, it is another, ultimate fact, two, that a unitary line will come. And that the final, ultimate fact, three, is that, when the nerve process is excited in combination with that other process which subserves the feeling of attention, what results will be the line with the local sign inside of it determined to a particular place. Thus we should escape the responsibility of explaining, by falling back on the everlasting inscrutability of the psychoneural nexus. The moment we call the ground of localization physiological, we need only point out how, in those cases in which localization occurs, the physiological process differs from those in which it does not, to have done all we can possibly do in the matter. This would be unexceptionable logic, and with it we might let the matter drop, satisfied that there was no self-contradiction in it, but only the universal psychological puzzle of how a new mode of consciousness emerges whenever a fundamentally new mode of nervous action occurs. But, blameless as such tactics would logically be on our part, let us see whether we cannot push our theoretic insight a little farther. It seems to me we can. We cannot, it is true, give a reason why the line we feel when process, too, awakens should have its own peculiar shape, nor can we explain the essence of the process of discriminative attention. But we can see why, if the brute facts be admitted that a line may have one of its parts singled out by attention at all, and that that part may appear in relation to other parts at all, the relation must be in the line itself, for the line and the parts are the only things supposed to be in consciousness. And we can furthermore suggest a reason why parts appearing thus in relation to each other in a line should fall into an immutable order, and each within that order keep its characteristic place. If a lot of such local signs all have any quality which evenly augments as we pass from one to the other, we can arrange them in an ideal serial order, in which any one local sign must lie below those with more, above those with less, of the quality in question. It must divide the series into two parts, unless indeed it have a maximum or minimum of the quality, when it either begins or ends it. Such an ideal series of local signs in the mind is, however, not yet identical with the feeling of a line in space. Touch a dozen points on the skin successively, and there seems no necessary reason why the notion of a definite line should emerge, even though we be strongly aware of a gradation of quality among the touches. We may, of course, symbolically arrange them in a line in our thought, but we can always distinguish between a line symbolically thought and a line directly felt. But note now the peculiarity of the nerve processes of all these local signs, though they may give no line when excited successively, when excited together they do give the actual sensation of a line in space. The sum of them is the neural process of that line, the sum of their feelings is the feeling of that line, and if we begin to single out particular points from the line, and notice them by their rank, it is impossible to see how this rank can appear except as an actual fixed space position sensibly felt as a bit of the total line. The scale itself appearing as a line, rank in it must appear as a definite part of the line. If the seven notes of an octave, when heard together, appeared to the sense of hearing as an outspread line of sound which it is needless to say they do not, why then no one note could be discriminated without being localized, according to its pitch, in the line, either as one of its extremities or as some part between. But not alone the gradation of their quality arranges the local sign feelings in a scale. Our movements arrange them also in a time scale. Whenever a stimulus passes from point A of the skin or retina to point F, it awakens the local sign feelings in the perfectly definite time order APDEF. It cannot excite F until CDE have been successively aroused. The feeling C sometimes is preceded by AB, sometimes followed by BA, according to the movement's direction, the result of it all being that we never feel either A, C, or F, without their clinging to it faint reverberations of the various time orders of transition in which, throughout past experience, it has been aroused. To the local sign of there clings the tinge or tone, the penumbra or fringe, of the transition BCD. To F, to C, there cling quite different tones. Once admit the principle that a feeling may be tinged by the reproductive consciousness of an habitual transition, even when the transition is not made, and it seems entirely natural to admit that, if the transition be habitually in the order APDEF, and if A, C, and F be felt separately at all, A will be felt with an essential earliness, F with an essential lateness, and that C will fall between. Thus those psychologists who set little store by local signs and great store by movements in explaining space perception, would have a perfectly definite time order, due to motion, by which to account for the definite order of positions that appears when sensitive spots are excited all at once. Without, however, the preliminary admission of the ultimate fact that this collective excitement shall feel like a line and nothing else, it can never be explained why the new order should needs be an order of positions, and not of merely ideal serial rank. We shall hereafter have any amount of opportunity to observe how thoroughgoing is the participation of motion in all our spatial measurements. Whether the local signs have their respective qualities evenly graduated or not, the feelings of transition must be set down as among the very causae in localization. But the gradation of the local signs is hardly to be doubted, so we may believe ourselves really to possess two sets of reasons for localizing any point we may happen to distinguish from out the midst of any line or any larger space. This transitional sensation of more must be identical with itself under all these different accompaniments, or we should not give it the same name in every case. We get it when we pass from a short vertical line to a long horizontal one, from a small square to a large circle, as well as when we pass between those figures whose shapes are congruous. But when the shapes are congruous, our consciousness of the relation is a good deal more distinct, and it is most distinct of all when, in the exercise of our analytic attention, we notice, first, a part, and then the whole, of a single line or shape. Then the more of the whole actually sticks out, as a separate piece of space, and is so envisaged. The same exact sensation of it is given when we are able to superpose one line or figure on another. This indispensable condition of exact measurement of the more has led some to think that the feeling itself arose in every case from original experiences of superposition. This is probably not an absolutely true opinion, but for our present purpose that is immaterial. So far as the subdivisions of a sense space are to be measured exactly against each other, objective forms occupying one subdivision must directly or indirectly be superposed upon the other, and the mind must get the immediate feeling of an outstanding plus. And even where we only feel one subdivision to be vaguely larger or less, the mind must pass rapidly between it and the other subdivision, and receive the immediate sensible shock of the more. We seem thus to have accounted for all space relations, and made them clear to our understanding. They are nothing but sensations of particular lines, particular angles, particular forms of transition, or, in the case of a distinct more, of particular outstanding portions of space after two figures have been superposed. These relation sensations may actually be produced as such, as when a geometer draws new lines across a figure with his pencil to demonstrate the relations of its parts, or they may be ideal representations of lines, not really drawn. But in either case, their entrance into the mind is equivalent to a more detailed subdivision, cognizance, and measurement of the space considered. The bringing of subdivisions to consciousness constitutes, then, the entire process by which we pass from our first vague feeling of a total vastness to a cognition of the vastness in detail. The more numerous the subdivisions are, the more elaborate and perfect the cognition becomes. But inasmuch as all the subdivisions are themselves sensations, and even the feeling of more or less is, were not itself a figure, at least a sensation of transition between two sensations of figure, it follows, for aught we can as yet see to the contrary, that all spatial knowledge is sensational at bottom, and that, as the sensations lie together in the unity of consciousness, no new material element whatever comes to them from a supersensible source. The bringing of subdivisions to consciousness. This, then, is our next topic. They may be brought to consciousness under three aspects in respect of their locality, in respect of their size, in respect of their shape. The meaning of localization. Confining ourselves to the problem of locality for the present, let us begin with the simple case of a sensitive surface, only two points of which receive stimulation from without. How, first, are these two points felt as alongside of each other with an interval of space between them? We must be conscious of two things for this, of the duality of the excited points, and of the extensiveness of the unexcited interval. The duality alone, although a necessary, is not a sufficient condition of the spatial separation. We may, for instance, discern two sounds in the same place, sweet and sour in the same lemonade, warm and cold, round and pointed contact in the same place on the skin, etc. In all discrimination, the recognition of the duality of two feelings by the mind is the easier the more strongly the feelings are contrasted in quality. If our two excited points awaken identical qualities of sensation, they must, perforce, appear to the mind as one, and, not distinguished at all, they are, a fortiori, not localized apart. Spots 4 centimeters distant on the back have no qualitative contrast at all, and fuse into a single sensation. Points less than 3/1000ths of a millimeter apart awaken on the retina sensations so contrasted that we apprehend them immediately as two. Now these unlikenesses which arise so slowly when we pass from one point to another in the back, so much faster on the tongue and fingertips, but with such inconceivable rapidity on the retina, what are they? Can we discover anything about their intrinsic nature? The most natural and immediate answer to make is that they are unlikeness of place pure and simple. In the words of a German physiologist, to whom psychophysics owes much, the sensations are from the outset, von vornherein, localized. Every sensation as such is from the very beginning affected with the spatial quality, so that this quality is nothing like an external,